President Trump is expected to sign a bill that addresses the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country.
Many of my friends from different tribal communities have a family member who's went missing or have had a family member who's been murdered, and they never received an answer of what happened. And so for me, it is personal, and it's a commitment I've made to people who I care about and I love.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 29th, we'll discuss the resources Congress will allocate to help this community. And as baseball playoffs begin, the percentage of African-American players has shrunk, but some current and former players are trying to change that from the ground up.
They are seeking a pathway to make sure that there is a future for Black people in this game.
Plus, a matter of faith in times of COVID. We check in with faith leaders to see how they're coping in these hard times. But first, we start with the president's taxes. On Sunday night, the New York Times published the first piece in an investigation detailing President Donald Trump's tax return data from the past two decades. According to the Times' reporting, the president did not pay federal income taxes in 11 of the 18 years they looked at. And he also reportedly just paid $750 in federal income taxes in both 2016 and 2017. The revelations about Trump's tax records come less than 6 weeks before the November election. And with the first presidential debate just hours away, some Americans will be watching closely to see what more the president has to say on the matter. President Trump defended his tax record on Monday by saying on Twitter that he was, quote, entitled to take advantage of tax loopholes like everyone else. For more on this, we turn to Jeffrey Stein, White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back on.
So a lot of tax code stuff to get through, but let's remind our listeners, why has the president not voluntarily disclosed his tax records so far?
Well, I think we're seeing the reason right now. The president broke decades of precedent in refusing as a 2016 presidential candidate to release his tax returns. He has claimed that he cannot do this because he is under audit, but there is nothing that would stop him from, say, having released all of the years of his tax returns prior to the current audit. The IRS has not made clear that Trump is unable to do this. And a lot of the attorneys we've spoken to have said that it might be difficult on some of the edge cases related to the audit. But, you know, overall, you know, he could do it. So that has been more or less a pretty clearly knocked down fallacy at this point. You know, the question of why he hasn't released his tax returns became a huge controversy in Congress. House Democrats sued for Trump's tax returns. The Treasury Secretary had to explicitly deny a part of the law that says that Congress, that the tax writing committees of Congress were entitled to the returns. And yet, of course, now we have them, or now the New York Times has them, I should say. And so we can see a little bit why Trump and his administration were so resistant for the public to see these documents.
And we know the New York Times didn't just get them yesterday. They've been working on getting them, or some semblance of them, for years now. One of the most striking features, at least to some Americans, was how little the president paid in federal taxes for 2016 and 2017. We're talking $750. Jeffrey, I think I've paid more in my own taxes. Is that how do we even get to that type of a figure?
That's a great question. So maybe I could try to explain it a little bit for the listeners. So most people, you and I, you know, we pay our federal income taxes on our wages and our salaries, right? We collect a check, you know, every other week from our employers. And then at the end of the year, that, you know, however much we make, there you go to the tax rate and you see for your income bracket how much you pay. So that's what most people do. And then separately, many people, I think most people actually work for companies, and the companies also pay what's called a corporate tax rate. Most, you know, many companies are formed as a C corp, it's called. And so they pay a separate corporate tax, which is now 21%. The Republican tax law lowered the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Donald Trump is actually in neither of those categories, either the personal income tax situation that I described for wages and salaries, or in the corporate business tax. He's formed as what's called, you know, a sole proprietorship or an S corp. These are called, you know, pass-through entities. And what a pass-through entity means, there's a bunch of different sort of legal formal legal structures that constitute pass-throughs, but the upshot is that the business owner pays his taxes on his business and his personal taxes sort of as one combined thing. So that means that his personal income tax obligations is often just reflective of what the business is doing. And in Trump's case, he's taking such tremendous losses, particularly on his golf courses, that he's able to offset his other tax obligations, including what we normally think of as your federal income tax obligations. Trump has a ton of money. He has a ton of assets, but what's known as his AGI, his adjusted gross income, which helps determine your federal income tax rate, is actually quite low, because if you're formed as a sole proprietorship or as an S-corp or as a pass-through, you're acquiring these assets. They're increasing your net wealth, but they're not actually leading to your average, you know, income to be that high. And that's why Trump's income payments, you know, federal income tax payments, were only $750.
But Jeffrey, I want to stop you there for a second, because I feel like there's a lot of stuff. I mean, that's super interesting. And a lot of Americans probably don't own golf courses and that are losing money and all that other stuff. This feels like something that really, I mean, that really sort of affects uber wealthy Americans, right? In terms of how they interpret the tax code and how they're able to take advantage of some of the loopholes that you're describing that the rest of us just aren't able to do. So what is it about the tax code that really favors wealthier Americans?
Well, that's a really great question. And just, you know, to the point that you just raised about the enormous discrepancy here, we talked to a bunch of tax experts who look at this data, and I looked at some of the data myself. It really seemed like Trump's average federal income tax payment in 2016 and 2017 amounted to the federal income tax payment of someone who earns between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. Average over the course of 20 years, from what we know about Trump's taxes, he probably paid the income taxes of someone who earned about $150,000 a year annually. And, you know, I don't need to tell anyone this, but just worth pointing out that Trump does not live like someone who, you know, makes $150,000 annually or $40,000 or $50,000 annually. He lives like a billionaire, and he has an incredibly lavish lifestyle, and the planes and the jets and the towers and the golf courses. I mean, you go on and on and on. But this legal structure that, you know, yeah, as you said correctly, most, you know, the vast majority of Americans do not have the capacity to deduct millions of dollars in business losses off of their taxes. And this is actually, you know, this part of the tax code is relatively old, but this is part of a longer trend in America where we really do not tax our rich people at the same rates as other countries, or really even at the same rates that we once did. Americans used to pay, at the top end of the income distribution, used to pay far more in taxes. In the 1960s, the richest 400 Americans had an average effective federal tax rate of well over 50%, and now that number is less than 25%. There's lots of complicated reasons for that, but a big part of it is that we have decided as a country not to tax the rich as much as we once did. We fund many social services at a less generous rate than we once did as a result, in part. And we've really underfunded the IRS. And the number one source of IRS audits, the IRS is going most aggressively at auditing the earned income tax credit, which is a credit for low-income workers. And the amount of IRS enforcement on the rich has really plummeted. So there's a lot.
So in other words, Jeffrey, I mean, there's been reporting on this that the IRS is aggressively going for what you said, the earned income tax credit. And those are largely low income workers, people of color, poor people, right?
That's correct. And I mean, we don't know exactly what the situation, or maybe the Times hasn't told us yet, and will later this week. But we don't know precisely what is going on with the IRS audit. But we can certainly say that as the IRS has stepped up enforcement of the poor, in part because, you know, it's low-hanging fruit. Poor people can't hire expensive attorneys to fight these battles in court. You know, a lot of the scrutiny of the rich has gone either neglected or undernoticed. And a big thing that the Times revealed is some of the ways in which Trump was dramatically stretching the bounds of these deduction rules. Ivanka Trump was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, even though she's an employee of the company. She was paid to be, quote, a consultant. And then the Trump organization deducted that payment to Ivanka as a consultant from its tax burden. So was that a legitimate payment? Was that something that, you know, those are real service offered through consulting fees that was critical to the business that warrants a tax write-off? We don't know exactly what's going on with the IRS audit in the specific case, but it's the kind of thing that the IRS is paying a lot less attention to, in part because Congress has told it to and has allowed that to happen.
What's interesting to me also, Jeffrey, is that when we think about the wealthiest people in this country, the 1%, and I've done a lot of reporting on who those folks are, 95% of that group are white people. They're very, very small percentages of people of color, Black people, Latinos, Asians, Indigenous people who also create or have that level of wealth. And I'm wondering, it's almost hard to imagine that a person of color in the same situation as Trump would be as supported, because we are hearing from some of his supporters that they think this is just fine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about sort of racial prejudice in the IRS, but, you know, given systemic racism in this country and in the government, it wouldn't surprise me one bit. And it's worth noting that, you know, even for rich people, Trump is exceptional. Mitt Romney and Warren Buffett, they pay low taxes. And there was a lot of scandal and outrage over their low tax payment. But they paid more than Trump appears to. And I would just add that, you know, we look at what's happening with the election, and you may certainly be right that the vast majority of Trump supporters don't care, but the polling for Trump has not been good. And, you know, Democrats don't need every Trump supporter to be outraged by this. They only need, you know, 5 or 10% of the people who voted for Trump in 2016 to say that this is outrageous and they won't, you know, maybe more of them will stay home, maybe they'll vote third party. The margins were so close in 2016 that Trump doesn't have a lot of room to lose.
Well, let's talk about that, Jeffrey, because we've got a debate in just a couple of hours between Joe Biden and President Trump. It's the first debate that we'll be having. We're very close to the election itself. Has the Biden campaign said anything about this? And what should we, how much do you expect this will come up in tonight's debate?
But Biden has, last night he tweeted about the need for the rich to pay their fair share. And I think that's a pretty clear jab at Trump. And from the Biden people I've spoken with, you know, their attitude is that, you know, this is not just a characterological issue as they see it about Trump. They also see this as a matter of economic policy where Trump has pushed. It's actually a little more complicated than they want to admit. But it is true that the 2017 Republican Tax Act, approved and signed into law by the president, reduce federal tax obligations for the 1% and the rich. They actually may have squeezed Trump in other ways. The state and local tax deduction, for instance, was dramatically scaled back. And since Trump lived in New York, that may have hurt him a little bit. But as a general matter, it's certainly true that Trump has benefited personally from this very low tax regime on the rich, and moreover that he has been a lead proponent of continuing to lower taxes for the rich. Trump and the Trump campaign has talked about cutting capital gains taxes in a second Trump administration. We've talked a lot about how, and reported a lot about how Trump has unilaterally looked at doing this, and so from the Biden campaign's perspective, this is a really ripe political issue where they see this link between Trump's own ability to pay only $750 in federal income taxes and Trump's policies of cutting taxes for the rich.
I'm going to leave it there. Jeffrey Stein, White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In a year that feels never-ending when it comes to death and despair, many Americans are leaning on their faith to get through it. Across the world, more than 1 million people have died from COVID-19. And here in the United States, the death toll has surpassed 200,000 people. The country is also deeply divided along political and racial lines. And for religious Americans, the pandemic has disrupted an important form of community, the ability to gather in person. And that's something that Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum addressed at the Yom Kippur service at the congregation Beit Simat Torah.
While none of you can be in the sanctuary with us, we want you to know that we really, really feel you here. And we really feel close and connected to you. And all of the things that you've done in these months, 6 months of our social isolation, has proven how profound it is to build spiritual closeness and depth no matter what the physical circumstances.
Over in Dallas, Texas, Imam Omar Suleiman addressed the moment with his congregation.
Wherever you are, death will find you, even if you were in a built-up fortress, even if you were to take all of the protocols necessary to ward off death, even if you were to be the healthiest person in the world, even if you drove the safest car in the world, even if all of the factors that are typically present in death are not present around you, yudrikum al-maut, it will catch you when Allah has decreed it to catch you.
And we're not only dealing with a coronavirus pandemic, we're also dealing with a pandemic of racism in the United States. And that includes the grand jury announcement last week that no police involved in the killing of Breonna Taylor would be charged in her death, which created another moment of pain and frustration for the racial justice movement. Here's Reverend Jackie Lewis in New York giving advice to her community about how to work through this moment.
The lack of justice in the Breonna Taylor case is devastating news. I'm so sorry for her family. On top of the daily paper cuts it is to be Black in America, this is really tough. Stay there, friends, with the pain. Stay where the heartache is. Stay where the grief is. Because right there, that's where the insight's gonna come. That's where the wisdom's gonna come for all of us to make America a new democracy.
Joining me now is the Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis, Senior Minister at Middle Collegiate Church in New York. Reverend Lewis, thank you for being with me.
I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you so much.
Also with us is Imam Omar Suleiman, founder and president of Yaqeen Institute for Islamic Research in Dallas, Texas. Imam Suleiman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
And Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum is with us as well. She is the senior rabbi at the congregation Beit Simchat Torah. Rabbi Kleinbaum, thank you for joining us.
So happy to be here with my multi-faith siblings.
Thank you all. And I think we can all take a page from all of the sermons that you that we heard at the top. I'd like to ask you, since March, when we were last on the show together, things have obviously changed. How do you feel that people's spiritual needs have changed? Sharon, let's start with you.
Well, we've just completed this season of these days of awe, the Yom Kippur, in which we've done this deep personal reflection. And it's included this moment of looking back over these 6 months with great intensity. And we are very much in the place of what does God want from us? And we are hit with these multiple plagues of the economic uncertainty and crisis, the racism, the virus, and the Pharaoh in the White House who continues to rage. I think the message is the same. We must deepen our faith, our sense in that the eternal and those things that are infinite will ultimately be much more powerful than the plagues that affect us now. And we have to have the hope that comes from believing in that form of existence, which is it's not just what's right around us right now. Each of us has to build for a future and be the foundation for a future, whether or not we individually will get there. That's what the foundation of my faith is that my job is to be part of building something for a future. It does not matter how bad it gets. It matters where my faith gives me the strength to keep understanding there will be others who need me to not give up, not give in. Despair is not a strategy, and to keep building for the future.
Omar, what about you? How do you think people's spiritual needs have changed since the peak of the pandemic, at least in New York?
Well, you know, the part of the sermon that you played in the beginning was actually this last Friday. You know, we had two deaths in the community, non-COVID related, one a car accident, one a drowning accident, both neighbors of the mosque, both leaving behind widows in their 20s with young children. And so I think that what happens is that you have this compounded sense of loss. So, you know, when there are other elements of grief that are present and, you know, that are isolating experiences, there are needs for things like closure and, you know, physical company, people to hug you, people to give you a shoulder to cry on. And I think that the prevailing sense of, you know, uncertainty that is around us has really caused people to ask questions of existence and purpose. And so we've had an interesting situation, right, where our community certainly has had much to lose and much to grieve. But at the same time, We have a heightened spiritual experience now where people are more attentive, more regular in their attendance of programs, even if they're virtual. And so I think the spiritual needs that people have right now are to answer questions of purpose. How do we connect to God? How do we connect to family in this time? How do we connect to, you know, the Quran and what we have in terms of religious? How do we answer the very purpose of our, the question of the purpose of our existence at this moment?
Jackie, quickly, before we end this part of the segment, what are your thoughts on that?
I really agree with you, Mom. This idea of the existential questions that are looming large for us right now. I mean, how can we even imagine a time of being this isolated from one another with so many deaths, with such trauma to Black bodies, with such political toxicity? All of these things make us wonder, where do we belong? How does it fit? And I'm always reminded of Howard Gardner saying that leaders tell compelling stories that answer these existential questions. So my colleagues know that the way we frame things right now, both the what we say and how we be, are hugely impactful to give people a lifeline and a way to hope in this time of despair.
Jackie, I wanted to circle back with you. What is the role of faith leaders right now? Because you were talking a little bit about that and you mentioned hope. Tell us more.
Thank you so much. I think our most important job right now is to bear authentic witness to the story, to the arc of the story that our faith traditions represent. We stand on the shoulders of great witnesses who've gone before us, each of us, where we know that our people have gone through rough times, hard times, over a way that with tears have been watered. And what we understand in that is this resilience and stick-to-itiveness and that, you know, God going to come and the people will rise up and love will actually win. And I think we have to remind our people of that, even as we also say, let us grieve together, let us mourn together. So we have a priestly role of rituals. We have a pastoral role of holding both pain and joy and hope, and a prophetic role that says, not now, but soon. Soon comes the love. Soon comes the deliverance. Soon comes the hope. And we know it because we've been here and hope comes.
Sharon, I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about this notion of moral courage. I feel like there are, in addition to the despair that many of us feel because of the deaths related to the virus and so many other things that are happening in this moment, as you mentioned, there feels like Americans expect a certain amount of politics in politics, but I feel like we're in a moment where many Americans are looking at this moment and saying there is a lack of moral courage on the part of our leaders. Where does the faith community, how can they step in that and fill the gap?
I think this is a really important question, and I'm so inspired what my beloved colleague just said. We have to be able to be that moral courage to call things as they are, to be able to really, with authenticity and truth-telling, say what the reality is. There is so many lies and falsehoods and twisting of the human actual experience. We have to reflect back and help create the sense of reality that people need to have. Yes, this is bad. And no, all human beings aren't terrible. And yes, there is love, and God exists in a way to surround us with that love. And God cries with those of us who are suffering. And this sense of being in this together, I think, is centrally important to be able to say, yes, what is happening, this is the reality that is existing. But it's not the only reality, in that we believe in the ability to experience the kind of resilience that our ancestors have gone through, to think back on those who lived through terribly difficult times, all to make sure that we would exist. They wouldn't want us to only fall in for the despair or the sense of being deflated from hopelessness. And so I'm inspired personally, and part of, I think, our role is to remind people of both the reality of the time we're in, the reality of what history has taught us, and the reality that we can be part of building a different future.
Omar, are you noticing a difference? And if any of the rest of you are noticing this, I'm curious to hear, in terms of who is coming to hear the messages in the mosque? Who is coming? Are there people who may have not come for a while and have now re-entered the faith community because of this moment?
Oh, well, we've had, I mean, obviously there was a great sense of anticipation on the part of the regulars to get back to any type of participation in person. So, you know, for us, we, you know, started praying on the lawn, observing all protocols and things of that sort, and then limited capacity within our mosques. And so the regulars have certainly been there, but it's been very interesting because we've seen a lot of people that did not used to come. We've had several people that have actually converted to Islam every week, actually, since the pandemic, at our faith community, so that are embracing a sense of faith and connection and things of that sort. But I would say that one of the most obvious populations that I'm seeing right now are younger people. And I'm very curious to see, once it's all said and done, what this has done to heighten the spiritual sensibilities of youth, of younger people. And I say youth, I mean people in their 20s, their 30s, that are reconnecting with a sense of faith, because, you know, we've never faced anything like this in our lifetimes. And because we're now having these existential questions, and faith offers an outlet to understand that this life is not to be lived just for the sake of this life, that there is more to this life than going to work and eating and drinking and, you know, and living our lives the way that we're used to living, that there is something deeper to it. And what that means is that we fill our lives with a more meaningful existence while we're here, and we pay attention to the meaningful eternity that awaits those that you know, that live it in the best ways.
Jackie, are you noticing, similar to the question I just asked Omar, are you noticing particularly, I mean, we're talking about people who are already faith followers, who have some sort of a spiritual practice, but there may be people who haven't done that or who haven't been as open to these messages in the past. And I'm wondering if you're seeing your congregation shift and change to maybe have people who may be re-entering their faith tradition or really experiencing it for the first time, given the moment.
Yeah, that is exactly our experience. I mean, we're not, sadly, we're not open yet. We are doing communion outside on first Sundays of the Eucharist, and we have gone from 8 people to 45 people outside. But 180 people have joined our church since March. That's a congregation, right? And we are finding that it is a lot of secular people, artists, activists, are finding their way to us because, like my colleagues, Middle's work is both about the spiritual and about the social, about the personal and about the collective. We understand that we are in the project of healing souls and the world, and people are finding us in social media, finding us online, and the fact that we can worship digitally seems like a portal that people are coming through. So I mean, not new attendees, new members, 180 since March, because I think people are looking for home and meaning and a way to understand this tragic time.
So we're not necessarily... I'm sorry, Jackie, continue.
No, I was just going to say, and they are looking for hope. So the message has to be, just repeating ourselves a bit, that authentic, gosh, this is the hardest thing, and there's more, and you can make a difference, and your community needs you, and love is a powerful force. The fiercest kind of love is what's going to walk us through these hot mess times. People want to hear that so much.
These are really hard times for so many people, and it feels as though we are, and many of you mentioned this at the top, we're just in a pandemic, on top of an economic inequality, on top of the polarization in this country. I think so many of people that I know have never lived through something like this, and we're sort of grasping at straws on how to manage this. What do you say to people who are just really in despair about the moment, really can't see the hope that we're trying to hold on to so tightly? Omar, how do you address that?
Well, first and foremost, you know, there's a verse in the Quran that I lean on frequently, which is, with every hardship comes ease. And, you know, a lot of times we interpret that verse, or we read that verse, as after hardship comes ease, even though it says with every hardship comes ease. And the point of that is to say that it's not just that after every hardship the ease will come. But if you pay close enough attention, it's not just the light at the end of the tunnel. It's the lights in the corner of the tunnel that you might not be paying attention to. It's the blessings that you still do have that, you know, you do your best to appreciate and to spend some time with and to sit with. And that, you know, that doesn't mean that you don't acknowledge the pain or the vulnerability. I think that my colleagues have spoken wonderfully about that importance of acknowledging the pain and the vulnerability that's there, because you can't find hope in delusion. We're hurting. We're all hurting. That our faith, you know, our faith leaders are hurting. I think it's important sometimes for people to even see that their faith leaders are hurting too, that we're all going through our own sense of loss. But try to find the ease and the sense of purpose that we spend our entire lives trying to find. And sometimes there's no better time to answer a question of existence than when that existence is, you know, is being so violated as it is right now.
Sharon, you mentioned we are just coming out of Yom Kippur, a high holy day for members of the Jewish faith. How was this year different than previous years in terms of the moment, the tone, the everything that's happening around us, this sense of where do we find hope?
Well, the first most obvious difference is that we usually have thousands of people gathering at the Jacob Javits Center to pray together, to be in community together for the 25-hour intensive retreat that Yom Kippur is, of reflection and fasting and personal transformation. And we were online. So that just that physical difference of being so used to being going so deeply connected, and we had to really work hard to create this community of worshipers far and near, and to have a spiritual connection through that medium instead of being in person. And that actually, while it had obviously some terribly huge losses, it actually created some incredible opportunities. Families who are far flung one from the other could all be attending services together and going through it together. People who, for whom leaving the house because of illness or age might be difficult, could feel equally as a participant via the computer and the screen. And it forced us to be creative, because the basic bottom line is still the same. We are called upon to be as deeply human as possible, and in that way express the greatest holiness in the world. We are created in the image of God, and our job is to keep imitating God. And just like in the beginning of the book of Genesis, we're told in the middle of tohu vavohu, in the middle of the chaos of the beginning of the world, God creates light. And so we understand that it's sometimes in the middle of chaos, in the middle of the worst chaos, it's our job to be the creators and the bearers and the sources of light. And we do that knowing that we have deep connections to those in the Muslim world, in the Sikh world, in the Christian world, in the Buddhist world, in the non-believer world, of people who are bringing light in the middle of this chaos. And I think that brings all of us a lot of hope and a sense of deep connection. But I agree with what my colleagues have said. We're having just an outpouring of interest in being connected and participating, and some of it's just the desperate need for community. And we live in an American culture which is at its core in many ways anti-community and very individualistic. Well, in this moment in which everybody is so deeply separated, people's yearning for community is really profound. And I believe in community we can find great holiness. And so we're experiencing that also. People are reaching out who might never have reached out before.
Jackie, when you hear this, these messages, and you think, I personally experienced, I'm one of those folks who says, I don't ask for help and I don't need it. And suddenly I found people from many different faiths helping me in this moment, helping me as a new mother in a pandemic, suddenly dealing with a lockdown and saying, I don't know what to do in any which way. And people of many faiths came to my aid, really deepening a sense of that there is some hope out there, that there is some positivity in this moment. But Jackie, as communities of color, particularly Black communities right now, are really under assault in this country. And I'm wondering, again, we've talked about the pandemic on top of a pandemic. How are you working with your congregation to heal some of that pain as well. And I will note that each one of you has had, you know, Muslim Americans have been targeted in their house of worship. Jewish Americans were targeted in their house of worship. African Americans were targeted in their house of worship. So these are three communities that have personal experience with this level of violence. How are we coming together in this moment to put a balm on some of that pain right now?
Yeah, this is the pandemic in the pandemic, right? Or the 400-year-long pandemic. Many of my staff are on strike today. When we're through talking, I'm going to go on strike today as well. Black women striking in honor of the life of Breonna Taylor. We're traumatized. Can we just be honest? Mm-hmm. Black people in this country right now are traumatized. We're not the only ones traumatized, but we are fully experiencing flashbacks of lynchings and bodies being burned and body parts being pulled off. And this whole idea of just the white supremacist narrative in our nation that is actually the crippling force for my Jewish colleagues, my Muslim colleagues, my Sikh colleagues, right? The at the border, this place where white supremacy is our shared enemy. And so we're doing, it's a multiracial church. I think you know that. It's interesting to be an anti-racist multiracial church so that the Chinese people and the Japanese people and the Black people and the white people and the Latinx people are all together shouldering the burden. We've been doing it for decades at Middle, but right now we've really doubled down. One, really training people. We're going to offer a third training around anti-racism work October 7 and 8. Some 4,000 people have come to those trainings, which is to say that the nation wants to learn despite the president's, you know, executive order to shut down that. I think also to love on each other in a way that is like really profound. We have a multiracial group of people working on voting rights. Shared work reminds us of how much we have in common. And your observation, this time of crisis can make us circle up our wagons and retreat into our tribes and grow our racism. That's happening. But what's also happening is that we're moving across faith and across race and across gender and sexuality toward humanity in lots of places, pockets of resistance where people are moving together, acting together, marching together, organizing together. And that is where I find hope, to watch it happen, connecting across difference.
And I just want to end by circling back. If each of you have a sentence or two to Omar's point, that it's not just congregants and Americans who are struggling through this moment, but faith leaders are struggling in this moment. We are also, or you are also, human beings and having human feelings. And, you know, we've interviewed even doctors on this show who are supposed to be, you know, the sort of front line that is unfazed by death and despair. And even they are struggling. So if each of you has a sentence or two to tell a little bit about how personally you are finding hope in this moment, I would appreciate it. Omar.
You know, I'm trying to develop my own individual prayer habits, and this is not something that I share much, but I think that the usually the community toil, you know, doesn't allow us to develop as much of our individual prayer habits. And I think that it's important for faith leaders that are so used to constantly leading congregation to develop their own prayer habits. And so I think just being more intentional and more regular about that, and then trying to use the discipline of that individual prayer habit to bring about some other regularity and other things in our lives. I think it's important for us to understand that as much as we are used to, you know, the superhero complex, that sometimes stepping away for an hour to refill our own spiritual reservoir so that we can be a source of spirituality for others is important. So taking the time to regularly step away for an hour and to refill your tank so that you can be there for others.
Sharon, what about you?
I completely agree. And I have to say that part of I'm lucky. I live in New York City, but now with the way of communicating, it doesn't really matter. I listen to a lot of my colleagues, including those on the phone, and I get to be able to hear other sermons and religious communities. It's been my tradition for many years, although I didn't do it this year, is the week before the High Holidays, I go to a different religious community's retreat center. And I spend a week in a different religious community's retreat center doing my own personal spiritual preparation to lead my community for the days of awe. And that's been a profound part of my spiritual life. And I continue to learn deeply from others. And I'm very grateful to be part of a world in which there are many different faiths that have things to deeply offer. And I just want to add something also about the racism issue, that we also have to always remember that racism affects every community. There are Black Jews, there are obviously Black Muslims, and we have to always understand that all of our folks are affected by racism, and that those of us who are white have to take a leadership role in fighting racism in this country. And we have to be the ones who are fighting it and visible and making sure that those of us who are white and of European descent do not stay silent. Racism is not a Black problem, just like anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem. And these things will only be solved when we create deep coalitions, and those of us who have any privilege because of the color of our skin make sure that we are out there on the front line speaking God's truth every day.
Jackie, finally, your thoughts on your own, keeping yourself motivated and full of hope in this moment.
Yeah, thank you. I have a really deep understanding that my Black life matters. That's what I want to say. But I get to sit down, I get to stop. And my friends at church will tease me and say, oh, we're seeing more of Jacqueline than Jackie. You know, Jackie's a workaholic. Friends, but Jacqueline is trying to emerge and take some breaths and do some more Sabbath, do some more exercise, and see my therapist every 2 weeks. The little clip you played at the top of the hour was my quoting her, we are in pain, but stay with your feelings, stay with the hurt, stay where it hurts. Because right where it hurts is where the wisdom is coming, where the healing is coming, where the insight is coming. So I have an every 2 week practice of dumping my stuff on her, and with her, she helps me make meaning of all the things that are happening. And I'm reminded that with her and family and friends, I'm not alone as I struggle through the very real personal pain of these days. I don't have to pretend that it doesn't hurt, and it will stop hurting when we together in the womb of mercy birth a better nation.
I'm grateful for the three of you and for your time today. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye, you guys. Happy days.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Kim from Booton, New Jersey. I have found myself spending a lot more time outside in nature and meditating. It helps me stay grounded and reminds me of how beautiful the world actually is that we're living in. Connecting to animals, the environment, and people. One spirit, one health.
My name is Alice, and I live in Kirkland, Washington. I'm a practicing Buddhist, which is an offshoot of Buddhism, and that's always been a personal practice for me. The chaos of 2020 forced me to live a life which, ironically, is closer to my idol, the dude, in that I'm unemployed. I'm being very deliberate, doing things to bring myself back to a calm place, respecting others' struggles, and abiding through it all. I feel like I have cultivated more respect for myself and my needs as a human being, but without that self-respect, I would have been a statistic long ago.
Hi, this is Matt from St. Petersburg, Florida. It is my firmly held conviction that neither God nor an afterlife exist, and that has pushed me to lead as full a life as possible while I'm here on Earth. I am finding hope during these times in my work as a nurse. I hope everybody's finding hope in their own ways.
This is Frank Johnson from The Colony, Texas. I am maintaining my faith through studying the Bible, God's Word, and also through many online Bible studies. We've actually increased our ability and offerings of Bible studies through Zoom and streaming, so it's working out for me well.
Hi, this is Jeannie from Waterford Township, New Jersey. I belong to a meditation group that's been together for almost 30 years. We get together every other month and around holidays to celebrate with one another. We'd met for a regular meeting in February and didn't meet again until this past weekend. It was so wonderful to see and be with everyone after so long. We had all missed each other terribly. And when we departed, everyone felt energized and connected.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
As we've been following on the show, Indigenous women around the country have fallen victim to violent crime for years. As of 2018, at least 500 Indigenous women and girls have gone missing or been murdered. And for some lawmakers, it's personal.
Many of my friends in from different tribal communities have a family member who's went missing or have had a family member who's been murdered. And they never received an answer of what happened. And so for me, it is personal and is a commitment I've made to people who I care about and I love.
That was Utah State Representative Angela Romero, who created a task force on murdered and missing Indigenous women to help close the information gap. Last week, the United States Congress passed legislation of its own after years of delays to address this crisis. The two bills attempt to bolster local and federal law enforcement resources needed to investigate these cases. President Trump is expected to sign the measures into law. Joining me now is Congresswoman Norma Torres, Democrat from Southern California and the sponsor of one of the pieces of legislation known as Savannah's Act. Congresswoman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Can you explain what some of the key components of Savannah's Act are?
Absolutely. This is such an important first step to ensuring that we bring justice to the families of these murdered and missing Indigenous women. What the bill does is it creates new guidelines for responding to these cases and incentivizes various law enforcement agencies to implement them. So in essence, what we're doing is we're saying, look, it's not good enough for a tribal government that may not have a whole lot of resources to have to bear the brunt of this investigation. We, our law enforcement agencies need to work together from state, local, and federal agencies working to support tribal law enforcement agencies to help bring about justice.
Congresswoman, the bill is named after Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. Who was she?
Savannah was a 22-year-old young woman who was 8 months pregnant. She was a member of the Spirit Lake tribe. And, you know, she was excited about bringing her new baby to the world, planning for the birth, you know, of her baby when she was invited next door to a neighbor's apartment. She was tricked into going there to go help them with a project, and instead the baby was cut out of her. So this is a horrific case that, you know, brought myself and many of my colleagues into action. And we said, you know, this horrible murder should not have happened, and we need to do better. As we started looking into how much violence is happening around Native women, we know that 84% of them experience some form of violence in their lifetime, and they're 10 times higher than the national average to be murdered. So that alone tells us that we need to pay better attention to this, and we need to ensure that we bring the folks that are committing these crimes to justice.
The Senate version of Savannah's Act was sponsored by Republican Lisa Murkowski. Congresswoman, I'm wondering, is there generally bipartisan agreement on the urgency of issues affecting Indigenous communities?
There generally is not a whole lot of bipartisanship in Congress, especially these moments. But I would say that it has been a great pleasure working with Senator Murkowski, because she brought us all together along with Mastos Cortez and Deb Halal on our side and myself. And we held meetings between ourselves on, you know, coordinating how we were going to work together to advance this piece of legislation, because, you know, we know that we didn't want it to get caught up in the process of systems and the bureaucracy as they got caught up 2 years ago, where, you know, Republicans thought bringing up Chief Kurds was more important than the lives of Indigenous women.
Congresswoman, the Attorney General's Justice Department would have to implement some pieces of Savannah's Act. That department is run by Attorney General Bill Barr. You have criticized publicly Bill Barr. Do you trust that his Department of Justice will do what it needs to do on this issue?
The Department of Justice is more than willing to help with this issue. Obviously, they're the ones that are going to have to come up with some minimum standards. They're going to have to come up with the training that is necessary. In addition to the funding, we have included funding for technical assistance and training for smaller law enforcement agencies that may not have the personnel to be able to help create a database to ensure that when bodies are found, we are able to identify them as Indigenous women that have come up missing.
What have we heard from tribal groups in regards to this legislation? This is something that's come up. I mean, the takeaway, we went to Salt Lake City, Utah last year to hold a forum on this issue, and there were many people there who were deeply concerned about this. Now that this is happening, what are tribal groups having to say?
Well, they were concerned, but now that they know that they have grants available to help them improve their the service that they provide, I think that they are more amicable and welcoming of the legislation. So we look forward to working with them on this issue moving forward.
And speaking of bipartisan support, Congresswoman, the president, President Trump, is expected to sign this. Were you surprised by his willingness to do that?
I was not surprised by his willingness to do that because, as I stated, we have worked so hard, both Republicans and Democrats, together. You know, this may have our names, and our names may follow by an R and a D, but really, we are deeply committed to this legislation and to make sure that it is implemented and to ensure that those folks who were afraid to come on board, we're concerned about the cost that they may have on their departments, you know, are made whole by these grants that will be available to them.
Congresswoman Norma Torres is a representative from Southern California. Congresswoman, thanks for speaking with me.
Great to be with you.
Major League Baseball playoffs begin today, and the league and its players' union are doing a little introspection with regards to who's actually out on the field. This month, the two organizations donated $10 million to the Players Alliance, a nonprofit group made up of over 100 current and former black players, which formed in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And that money will be used to help recruit young black players to the sport. And that's important to note because Major League Baseball has a deficit of African American players right now. Only 8% of the league is African American, compared to nearly 19% back in the 1980s. And the front office situation isn't much better. Bradford William Davis is a sports columnist covering Major League Baseball for the New York Daily News, and he joins me now. Bradford, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So let's start with a complicated question. Why is it that Major League Baseball has such a lack of black players right now?
To distill it as quickly as possible, there is a significant barrier of entry to playing baseball on the youth level. Travel ball, which ends up being a significant showcase for amateur, adolescent, teenager, you know, high school talent, that costs a lot of money to play. And given the gross economic disparity between black Americans and white Americans, of course, there's going to be a disparity reflected in who gets to actually be at those things. Major League Baseball does do some things, you know, on that end, and this $10 million donation between the league and the Players Association, being the baseball union, is supposed to address some of that, but it is not sufficient, and as you can see by the utter lack of black participation. And that flows upwards. I mean, you know, colleges do not give out scholarships to the same degree as they do for basketball or football, which makes it harder again for a historically and presently disadvantaged group to justify going to college, even an elite D1 program, if they have to pay for most or all of it, when they may have athletic talent elsewhere that could actually, you know, pay their way through. Those are significant reasons, and, you know, that leads to a culture that is perceived, and rightfully so, as very white dominant, which makes it very uncomfortable to be a black player on any level, from the youth level to professional, minor league, or Major League Baseball.
One trend, however, that has changed the literal face of baseball has been the increase of Latino players, many of them coming from out of the country. Some of these players are themselves black. They are Afro-Latino. Where do they fit into this?
First of all, it is wonderful to see the explosion of Latin talent in baseball. That is, their obvious love and gifting at the sport is extremely good and welcoming, and adds so much to what makes MLB fun when it is fun. At the same time, you know, even though many of those players actually do hail from the African diaspora, you know, they aren't, at least in the front-facing way, you know, sort of embracing anything from the disproportionate amount of black people in the game of baseball, whether in, you know, again, rosters or front offices or whatever, to the current civil rights causes that affect black people, regardless of your country of origin. They're just not present for that. They aren't really at the forefront of this. They're not speaking out with the same regularity that you see, that you're starting to see black players, you know, speak out on issues that affect, you know, the game and affect, you know, the political world outside of it.
I should just reiterate that some of those players are themselves black, but I guess the bigger issue, those players, a lot of them are also sourced from outside of the United States. I don't know if that might have anything to do with what you're describing.
I think it does, Cinzina. I mean, I don't say that with, you know, lack of empathy, because, I mean, you know, there is a privilege that comes with being a United States citizen that I think gives you a little bit more freedom with which to speak out about things that matter to you without feeling like any sort of retribution may come. I think that's a very understandable sort of fear and concern. However, there's also a lot of anti-blackness across, you know, the Latin diaspora, not, which again is not unique to any place in the world, I guess, but it's certainly true, you know, among many Latin countries that have, you know, black folks in it. And so I think that is a real part of it as well, of just, you know, not identifying in a sort of social way with African-American players.
Bradford, who are the Players Alliance?
Well, there is a coalition of black current and former players that banded together this year, really, to address issues primarily inside, but sometimes outside of the game as well. I think they are seeking a pathway to make sure that there is a future for black people in this game, you know, one where they do not feel pushed out, where they don't have to be the only person on their roster, the only person on their minor league team. That's very hard. It's very isolating, you know, and also because they believe that baseball brings joy. It brings opportunities, you know, even if you don't make it to the league, it's like it's a good and beautiful thing to be a part of, you know, and they want to bring that to communities that have had baseball, largely due to cultural and economic reasons dovetailing together, taken away from them, especially when it becomes a more competitive thing. And as you get older, but you're still a child. So, that is the Players Alliance. You know, it's black current and former players seeking to change the game from within.
The Players Union and Major League Baseball donated $10 million to the Players Alliance. Is that enough?
Look, I mean, always take the money, right? I'm very happy that they have this investment from, you know, both their union and the league to do some of the things that matter to them, including, again, you know, diversifying the game on the youth level. I think that is extremely important work and can really benefit a lot of kids. Do I think that in and of itself, you know, will change the game to a place where it is sort of in a positive sense reflective of the country and the many people that make it up? I don't think so. I think there's, you know, there's a lot more time and money that needs to be spent in that. Not just recruitment in a branding sense, but like, you know, but in creating huge, large pathways that address every single sort of impediment that a young, talented black athlete might face when they're deciding between baseball or basketball or baseball and football. 10 million won't fix 400 years of disparity.
And I mean, I'm a baseball fan. I enjoy the pace of the game. I think it's a very soothing game to watch, and Frank. But I think there are lots of people who say it's just boring and it doesn't really elicit the same type of excitement as the ones that you just mentioned, football, basketball, for example. Could that be another reason why folks are just not as attracted to the sport right now?
I mean, I can understand why some might argue that baseball is boring. Maybe it's a worse product. I'd say I have two points to that, though. One is football is slow as hell. Like, come on.
I agree.
Like, I think that is wildly overblown. You know, I'm a Jets fan, so like I know football can be very boring if you have the right or wrong amount of talent, you know, involved in it. And there's lots of stops and starts in that. But I also think that like the way that Black and Latino players as well play the game, they play it with a lot more joy and freedom. You see a guy like Tim Anderson, like he plays the game like baseball is fun to be played. A lot of, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the game has been so stoic in its nature, but that doesn't necessarily make the most entertaining product. And that stoicism is enforced where if you like celebrate your wins too much, you know, you pump your fist too much, you do a bat flip, you hit a grand slam, you know, while already up, like Fernando Tatis Jr. did a couple months ago, you know, could see yourself, you know, getting retaliated against with a ball to your butt or your head or whatever, you know, and that like discourages, you know, the beauty of competition, of being great at what you do, of you know, celebrating your wins, that, you know, the kind of stuff that like makes for great photos and great videos and great sports and clips, that, you know, that is so often in baseball more than basketball or football, you know, especially basketball, discouraged. And that's a shame. But like, but again, you have more of us, like, you know, I think you would begin to see a change in the kind of culture over like what gets celebrated, what gets penalized, hopefully a lot less. Different people being their whole, full, authentic selves whenever they step to the plate or on the mound or in the field. That is, I think, what helps baseball sell itself a lot more and makes it sort of a cool thing that kids might enjoy a little bit more. So, you know, pace of play is a problem. Like, I'm not saying it's not, but it is in football. But there are many other intersecting issues that lead to baseball being less popular or declining in popularity.
Bradford William Davis is a sports columnist covering Major League Baseball for the New York Daily News. Bradford, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all we've got today, folks. We hope you enjoyed the show. It's been a fast-paced news cycle, as you know, but we're going to get through it together. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. And of course, we love hearing from you. So continue to call us about stuff at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-865-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.